The following is a Super Network production with Super Marcy.
It really just gives you that feeling that you're in the outback, but also just one man's almost journey into the brink of madness.
The terrible Australian Bee Jermaine.
There's so many, like, characters in this whole film that are just so interesting, and you could easily just build a whole movie around them.
It contains coarse language.
Yeah, and it sort of wrecks his psychological state to the point where he basically
mature themes.
It's important to see this because this is what shit's like. It's not making this shit up. People do go out and do this kind of stuff.
Potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Listener discretion is advised. Please find us at supermarcy.com and subscribe to us via Patreon at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy.
G'day everyone, this is Bee Jermaine, aka The Terrible Australian, and welcome to episode 3 of the Ozploit podcast, the podcast where my co-hosts at Super Marcy and I do a deep dive into Australia's Ozploitation cinema from the very beginning till today. And with me, as always, is my lovely co-host, the one, the only, Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy. How are you?
Hello. Doing well, thank you, Bede. And how are you?
Pretty good, thanks. All excited to record the third episode of the Ozploit cast because since our last episode, which we did last month, the show has actually been quite successful. Like, the downloads and everything for our previous show just skyrocketed on the second episode compared to the first. So I'm really happy that a lot of our listeners out there, both old and new, are really enjoying us talking about these Australian genre films.
Yes, and I hope they continue to do so. It's great to watch these Australian films, and for me, a lot of them is for the first time. And, you know, for people out there who may not know much about Australian cinema, these just will open your eyes to so much that is out there.
Oh, indeed. And just during, like, even on this third episode, like, some of the films that we've done so far, some of which I have seen before, but there have others that I've never seen before. So that's been pretty exciting just to check out. And a vast range of Ozploitation films I've never seen. And I know over the next, well, in the future, all of our episodes, they're going to be so much more that, you know, you and I haven't seen before. So I'm definitely excited to see what we think of them, but regardless of whether they're good or bad. But we know that they're just going to provide a lot of interesting conversations for us, for sure.
Absolutely. I look forward to watching all of them, even if maybe they're problematic or they look bad. You know what? I'm just taking that chance and I'm going to watch them. So, yeah, we have 5 films per episode because there are so many Ozploitation films. If we only covered 1 or 2, and considering we're pretty much doing every single film we can find, we would still be doing this podcast into our 90s.
Indeed. And that's why I think it's also interesting to kind of make our podcast stand on its own, because there are quite a few Ozploitation podcasts out there, which are also really good and should also, our listeners should also give those a listen as well. But yeah. I think in terms of, like, what we can do to kind of stand out and be different from the other ones is, you know, the fact that we are talking about 5 films per episode, but we're kind of going from the literal beginning of when Ozploitation began, which was in the early 70s, and going year by year right up until today. So we have about at least just over 50 years of movies to talk about.
Yes, we do. And for our listeners out there, if you want to check out some of the other Ozploitation podcasts we've come across, that would be awesome. We here at the Super Network and the Ozploit cast love and adore all our fellow podcasters, and we just want to spread the love and give them a shout out. So check out Podsploitation, and you can find them on Twitter and all of that. Just look up Podsploitation, And then there is also a Dingo Ate My Movie, which is a really great title.
Indeed. I'm kind of jealous we never quite came up with that title for our show.
I know, how ridiculous, but absolutely love the title. You can find them on Twitter at Dingo Movie, and you should be able to find a Dingo Ate My Movie on all the podcast streaming services. And, you know, shout out to the latest episode where they talk about Wake in Fright. And, I was giving it a listen. It was a pretty good and fun episode. And, yeah, the discussions from ours were quite different, which was really, really interesting. So it's great to get all sorts of different perspectives. Were there any other ones that you know of that you want to give a shout-out to, Bede?
Oh, definitely. My friend Sean Coates, he hosts a podcast called Another Bloody Movie Podcast, which is a pretty awesome title of itself.
That's another great title, yes.
But he also is, like, he does kind of different kind of series of shows through his podcast, and he's doing one on Australian cinema, which is going by the name of Podcasts at Hanging Rock.
Oh, yeah. So,
and their first step, and his first step, like, first film for that series of podcasts is on Wake and Fright as well. So he and another special guest do an entire episode dedicated to that film. And I've given that one a listen to, and there's a lot of great discussions on that one. So if anyone's interested to hear Sean's thoughts on Wake and Fright and also Australian cinema, not just exploitation cinema, but all of Australian cinema, definitely check out Another Bloody Podcast, particularly with that show, Podcast at Hanging Rock.
Yes, and hopefully down the track we might be able to collaborate with some of these podcasts and, you know, share the love around for Australian cinema and exploitation. So, yep, definitely check them out. So, Bede, where are we starting today?
Indeed. For this episode of the Ozboy Cast, the five films we're going to be talking about for this one are going to be The Adventures of Barry McKenzie, Alvin Purple, Libido, The Cars That Ate Paris, and Peterson. So we definitely have five very different films that I think are definitely going to be worth discussing. Mm-hmm. So we'll get right to it with the 1972 film The Adventures of Barry McKenzie.
Listen, mate, I need to splash the boots. You know, strain the potatoes.
G'day, ladies and gentlemen. Barry McKenzie's the name.
He's got a great big grin and a great big chin. Give him half a chance, he'll be in like Flynn. His great big fist will flatten any palm. He's got a great big thirst, you can do your worst. When they tap the cave, he'll be in there first. It's no use, mate, you never win. He's a bellyman and you are Gunga Din.
Raymond, this is Barry McKenzie.
Go and stick your head up a dead bear's bum.
Look, Barry, seriously, I've been promising myself a trip to the old country ever since Norm's little operation. My family came from Britain many moons ago, you know.
Hello, sir. I'm terribly sorry, but somebody must have let that Australian lunatic on the set.
Excuse me, sir. Have you the time?
Sorry, sport, but point of established fact, at the present period of time, me watch wrist has shaken hands with my wife's best friend.
From the team that brought you, sir,
unbutton the mutton. You know, point Percy at the porcelain.
I think he wants to go to the loo.
Which was directed by Bruce Beresford, which I believe was his directorial debut. And for those out there who don't know who Bruce Beresford is, he's a director behind after this film, he would make such classic Australian films such as Break and Morant, The Fringe Dwellers, and also most recently, Ladies in Black. And also, he has directed quite a number of international films, particularly directing Driving Miss Daisy, which actually won the Oscar for Best Picture back in 1989. So he also co-wrote this film with actor-comedian Barry Humphries, which, of course, is based on the comic book strip of the same name, which Humphries created, which is also features illustrations by Nicholas Garland. And the film stars Barry Crocker, Barry Humphries, Spike Milligan, Peter Cook, Dick Bentley, Dennis Price, Julie Covington, and so much more. And Marcy, what is the plot summary for The Adventures of Barry McKenzie?
And the synopsis from the lovely IMDb: young Australian Barry McKenzie travels to England with his aunt Edna after his father dies and a request is revealed in his will.
Awesome. Now, Marcy, I've seen The Adventures of Barry McKenzie before, but I want to know what your thoughts are on it, since this was the very first time you had ever seen the film.
Yes, indeed. I had known about the film, The Adventures of Barry McKenzie. I maybe had seen the odd scene here or there, but I had not actually seen the film in full until, you know, recording this episode. And I will admit I was not overly excited about watching it, but maybe that's just because I think of the impression that Not Quite Hollywood gave of this film. And so I started watching it, and maybe the first 10 minutes I was like, oh, what is this? But as the film progressed, I was finding myself kind of enjoying it and understanding like what sort of humor and approach and kind of satire in a way that they were going for. And yeah, as I've noticed with this kind of like for the time, the new wave of Australian cinema, the films are like a lot of random scenes just kind of put together. And Barry McKenzie definitely feels like a bunch of skits that just kind of come together. And yeah, I actually found myself enjoying the film. There are definitely a lot of problematic issues in the film. And while I don't condone these things, and I believe I've said this before, I don't, you know, while I don't agree or condone some of the language and things used in the film, I can understand this is from when it was made. Yeah. And you know, people just really, at this point, people really didn't give a shit what they were doing. They just kind of wanted this bizarre freedom to do whatever the hell they wanted. So I can understand, like, the time it's from, and I can also understand that, yeah, even then it probably was not okay to use this kind of type of language and so forth. So that's, you know, that's my thoughts. So I won't repeat that with every single film. But, yeah, I found myself finding the character of Barry McKenzie actually quite endearing. There was kind of a very, like, larrikin ochre charm to the character. And I think Barry Crocker actually does a really good performance as Barry McKenzie. I think he hit most of the right notes in terms of comedy. And I just thought he was really, really good. And certainly Barry Humphries as... well, mostly as Aunt Edna, because he does play a couple of other roles in the film, I think is quite decent. There are some jokes that did hit the mark, some that didn't quite do it. But overall, I would say that I really didn't mind the film.
Yeah, well, I kind of agree with you as well. Like, this is my second time watching Barry McKenzie. I remember, I think the first time I watched it was probably maybe somewhere between, probably over 10 years ago.
Mm.
The first time I watched it, I didn't really think much of it, because it kind of was like one of the main reasons why I didn't really like the film at the time was I kind of, well, it's like any comedy. I kind of judge comedies about how much they make me laugh. Our good friend Sam Inglis, he has, when it comes to comedies, he has this thing called the 5-joke ratio when it comes to comedy. So if a movie makes him laugh or at least giggle or chuckle at least 5 times, it's that makes it a successful comedy. But if it doesn't, it doesn't really like it, then it just doesn't work as a comedy. Yeah. And I think at the time it didn't really work for me that well. And I just didn't feel like any of the jokes landed. And also, I just felt the film felt very cringy to me as well. Like, even though, yeah, this film came out in 1972, a lot of it kind of, like, it's very sort of full on with its Australian humor, and it just felt very cringy kind of to me. And I almost felt kind of embarrassed for Australia watching it. but rewatching it again now in prep for this show, I kind of do have a bit more of an appreciation for it. I think, like, in terms of a film on its own, I think as a comedy, it is a mixed bag. Like, again, a lot of the jokes kind of miss more than they hit. Because, you know, it's a different type of style. I mean, I have a sort of my own sort of sense of humor and what type of humor I like. So there are definitely jokes and all that worked in this film, but there were some others that just didn't really work for me, and particularly kind of the more lowbrow kind of stuff as well. And also, like you said, there definitely is some problematic elements as well, particularly with certain sort of free usage of, you know, sort of homophobic slurs or racial slurs and stuff like that. But like you, I can understand that, you know, this was, you know, 1972. So, you know, people didn't really think about that stuff back then. Not that I excuse it or anything like that, but I understand the context of the time of when this film was made. But now but that being said, though, I kind of did quite enjoy it as well. Like, as for what it is, I do agree it is basically more of like a bunch of sketches kind of strung together by a very loose plot. And it just basically follows, like, literally the adventures of this character, Barry McKenzie, and all the shenanigans he gets up to while in London. But there are some pretty amusing moments as well. And some of the characters that he meets along the way are kind of a mixture of, like, yeah, problematic, but also kind of fun as well. If you don't take the film seriously, because I think at the end of the day, this is a film that doesn't take itself or any of the situations seriously at all.
Absolutely,
But that being said, though, I think the movie probably would have been better if it was maybe 15 or 20 minutes shorter, because I do think it's a little bit longer than it needed to be.
Yeah, I do think it is maybe a little bit too long. But going back to what you said just before, I think within that sort of first 10 minutes of when I started watching it, I kind of got into this mindset of, this movie's not taking itself so seriously. I'm just going to watch this and not take it too seriously. And I think that definitely kind of made it a much easier watch in the end.
Yeah, and I think as well, like, even with the sort of the problematic elements of the film, like, even though we don't condone any of that at all, but I think at the same time, this is a film that is so unabashedly un-PC and also kind of is an equal opportunist in who it sort of fires a lot of its humor at, so everyone sort of you know, is a target in terms of the film's humor, but most importantly the British, because the British seem to get short end of the stick when it comes to a lot of the humor in this film.
It's definitely a lot of, you know, taking the piss, so to say, out of Aussies, out of the British. So much. That's really what a lot of these sketches are. It's the two sort of, you know, Australian characters being that fish out of water in England. And, you know, knowing this was based on like a comic strip, the film itself actually does have that kind of feel.
Definitely.
Just sort of these interconnected, little, you know, scenes and segments that are kind of just, you know, the things they all have in common is, like, it's these two out-of-towners, basically. So it's these series of misadventures. If you think of something like Borat, it's kind of like putting him in these situations that, you know, there's all this miscommunication, and he's obviously, you know, he takes the piss out of it himself with that. It kind of reminds me of that, but, you know, Borat, the actual film, kind of had a story, whereas this one's not much of a story. I mean, there's something there, but, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, it's kind of like it does have the setup of where Barry's dad dies and leaves, you know, an inheritance to him in his will. So he goes off to the UK with aren't in the, aka Damon in the Everidge, to sort of go there. But after that, that's just basically it. We just follow Barry on these misadventures. But what I really like, though, is, like, even though, yeah, it sort of makes fun of British life, it also, like you said, also is a satire on Australian life as well. Like, one of the first things we basically see is once Barry gets to Britain, like, he sort of, like, goes to declare his luggage and all that, and he opens up his bag, and inside is just an entire bag full of Foster's beer.
I can't lie. I think I laughed so hard when I saw all the stupid Foster's, and I think I snorted when I was laughing. That was a joke, and I think especially over the last few years, well, we've talked so much about how no one here drinks Foster's. I think that joke just hit me so hard that I laughed immensely. And I'm still laughing now.
Indeed. And I do love the run. There's one gag, like a running gag throughout the film I do enjoy, is like anytime like Barry opens up a can of Foster's or his whippies with other Aussies he meets throughout the film, every time they open up a can, like, the beer foam goes literally shooting out of the the can. But it's like every time they do it, the stream just gets bigger and bigger.
Yeah, I know. So I noticed that too, and I'm like, that's actually very clever.
Indeed. And you know, even Barry Humphries as Dame Ed, I mean Aunt Edna, I should say, she's not Aunt Edna's not Dame Edna yet, but even as Aunt Edna, there's definitely some great one-liners from Barry Humphries as that character. And I think one of my favorite ones is basically Barry and Edna, they go off to meet this British family who were friends of Barry's dad. And like, they go there, and Edna has a spaghetti bolognese for dinner. And she basically says, like, oh, how delightfully refreshing traditional old English meal that was, Mrs. Gordon. That's the character's name. And Mrs. Gort's like, oh, thank you. And it's and Aunt Edna's like, and how unusual to serve spaghetti bolognese without the toast. Just little lines like that actually did make me laugh.
Yeah.
Because it's so dry as well. So
yeah, it sort of just comes out of nowhere and it does make you laugh.
Yeah, exactly. And I kind of appreciate the film on that regard. Like, even if I don't think, like, the humor itself is very hit and miss. And, yeah, I mean, obviously, yeah. And also, like, it does, you know, obviously have problematic elements in it. But I think, like you say, there, like, it's a film that doesn't take itself seriously. It does sort of poke fun at everything and everyone. And it plays, and it actually has a good bit of satire in it as well. And I think also the endearing performance of Barry Crocker as the title character also works as well. Like, that character could have easily have come across as very obnoxious, but I think how he sort of plays the character is quite charming, and you can even forgive all the things that he, all the shenanigans his character gets up to. Although I got to say, I remember when you were watching the film, you kept texting me because, like, have you ever heard any Australian ever say any of the lines?
Yes, that's
right. Every film? And I think that's another thing as well, because, like, legit, like, every line feels like a cliche of what Aussies say. And I will admit, some of them I've never heard of before, and others I'm like, oh, yeah, I've heard some of those growing up.
Yeah, some of those, like, some I knew, some I didn't. And that's what I texted you going, do Australians say this? I was like, I have no idea what's going on.
And I legit think, like, if this movie, I mean, I'm assuming the movie, like, was released in the US, but I would not be surprised they would legit had to have subtitles for these scenes to even clarify what all the Australian characters are even saying half the time.
Yeah, I had no idea what was going on. But yeah, no, this film does have a charm to it. And as you mentioned, and I think I already mentioned it as well, but yeah, the endearing sort of character and performance with the character of Barry McKenzie is, I think it really helps sort of make this film very watchable. And comedy in itself is very, very subjective. So what will make me laugh might not make you laugh. And I think, you know, on a film's merits, like, if its aim is to be a comedy, and at least some people that watch it do find it funny. At least that's worked in some way. But I do think, yeah, this film was not really what I was kind of expecting it to be. And yeah, I actually really didn't mind it. I did get a little bit out of this film.
Indeed. And it's funny, like, reading back, like, when this movie came out, it was, like, the first Australian film to make $1 million at the box office. So it was, like, a hit at the time. But it did get a lot of negative reaction from critics. And funnily enough, though, like, if a movie like this came out today, kind of the sort of more sort of, you know, sort of like our kind of group of people, like the more left-leaning kind of people would definitely criticize this film. But at the time, though, the film was actually very much hated by conservatives, which I think is kind of interesting. Although, sort of reading up information about the film, there was definitely people of the LGBTQ community that did have issues with the film as well, and deservedly so.
Yeah, rightfully so.
And so it's kind of interesting kind of seeing, like, the sort of the reaction, like, the backlash it had back then to, like, what this film, like, a film like this would play with audiences now. So it's kind of interesting seeing, like, this is a film that I guess every group hated.
Yeah, in some way, I think everyone's hated this film.
Indeed.
But, yeah, like, I definitely don't ignore or look past any problematic elements. They're definitely there, and I acknowledge that they're there.
Yeah.
And, you know, aside from those things, like when they're not doing those things, I think there are definitely things in the film that do work. And I definitely understand that they just really didn't give a shit. They wanted to offend everybody.
Indeed. And also, like, also not unafraid to gross people out, because I know, let's talk, like, the Chunda scene, for example.
Yeah. Lovely.
So. Which is, like, a film so disgusting. I think I read somewhere that Bruce Beresford himself actually refused to direct that scene because it was so gross.
Yeah, I don't blame him.
And also finding out that this film was shot by Donald McAlpine, who would go on to be a major cinematographer in both Australia and Hollywood, even getting an Oscar nomination for Moulin Rouge.
There you go.
But it's interesting, like, I just keep laughing. Like, the fact, thinking, like, I want the person who made The Adventures of Barry McKenzie to direct Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah, I mean, totally. It wasn't because of, like, any of the other films he made after this.
Indeed. But it's interesting, though, like, kind of seeing Bruce Beresford start in this and seeing, like, the kind of more critically acclaimed kind of sort of Hollywood or Oscar-baity kind of films that he would make later on in his career. So, yeah. But, yeah, so... to wrap up our talk on Barry McKenzie, Marcy, what is your rating for this film and your final thoughts on it?
Okay, so I gave this film 3 out of 5 suitcases full of Foster's beer. Yeah, look, I almost expected that I would just really not like this film, but that ended up not being the case. I would say just, you know, have a kind of content warning that, you know, there are problematic elements and some people may not, you know, need to necessarily hear or see that and such and such. But if you are looking to see kind of some more earlier origins of this kind of new wave of Australian cinema, then check out The Adventures of Barry McKenzie. Bede, what is your score and final thoughts?
Indeed, I give it about 3 out of 5 as well. Like, as a film, it's definitely not perfect. It is problematic. But I think at the same time, though, it's a film that doesn't take itself seriously at all. And I think if you kind of watch it through that kind of lens, then it will definitely be enjoyable. But at the same time, though, I would not disagree with anyone having any problems with this film as well for those kind of same reasons why it's problematic. So... But, yeah, I mean, but outside of those moments, like you say, it is a pretty endearing and reasonably enjoyable comedy. Like, some of the jokes are hit and miss, but it does have, but it does make up for it in other ways, particularly kind of like how unabashedly Australian it is, and also Barry Crocker's performance as well.
Yeah. All right.
All right, we'll move on to our next film. which of course is the 1973 sex comedy Alvin Purple.
Meet a man of many parts, all of them in full working order.
He is what's clinically known as a pteromaniac. That's the male equivalent of an infomaniac. He can't keep his hands off anyone.
Alvin Purple. Handsome. Charming. Artistic. From the very start, it was obvious here was a young man with a big future in front of him.
He'll get pregnant, you know.
And won't you be jealous?
Let go!
He was a popular student. Always on good terms with the staff.
Oh,
Mrs. Hood.
There are openings everywhere for the right man. Find out what you want to do, and then extend yourself.
He became a dedicated salesman.
In this world, there's no one who can afford to be slack.
In fact, he spent most of his time on the job.
I'm still afraid of the dark.
Big girl like you?
I'm only big on some things.
Soon he was a leader in his field. What's Alvin's secret? You'll have to see the movie to find out. Tim Burstall, who gave you the outrageously funny stalk, now takes a wickedly witty look at sex through the eyes of a reluctant superstud. There's more, much more. If you liked Bedroom Mazurka and What's Up, Doc, then you'll love Alvin Purple.
Which is directed by Tim Burstall, who we have talked about before, having directed, previously talked about his previous film, Stalk, on the last episode of the Ozboy cast.
Mm-hmm.
The film was written by Alan Hopgood, and the film stars Graham Blundell as Alvin Purple, along with Abigail, Lynette Curran, Jackie Weaver, Christina Moore, Dina Mann, and George Whaley. And Marcy, what is the plot summary for this film?
Okay, so I actually have the plot summary from Letterboxd. We did it for Alvin. Alvin is your average guy, except for the fact women find him irresistible and chase him everywhere. He tries to avoid them and gets psychiatric help, but gets used by the psychiatrist as a gigolo to treat other patients instead.
Indeed. And again, like Barry McKenzie, I have seen Alvin Purple before. But Marcy, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it. Just like Barry McKenzie, this is your first time watching the film. So what did you think of it?
Yeah. So again, this was a film that I knew about. I knew it had a bit of a reputation in the land of cinema Australia. And again, I'd seen some sort of out of context scenes. So yeah, my first time watching it. And I enjoyed what we watched previously from Tim Burstall with Stalk. So that definitely sort of had my curiosity about, you know, how this film would be. And considering that, you know, I didn't mind Barry McKenzie. I was very open-minded with Alvin Purple. But this film has a few problems. I'll start with the more positive aspects. Graham Blundell as Alvin Purple, I think he does a great job here, and he's someone that we've already seen several times with the films that we've watched for this podcast. So, you know, we know he's a fairly, you know, good actor, and he's the lead here. And I actually thought he did really good. I think for the kind of character they had written Alvin Purple to be, I think he fit that really, really well. And I do think this film actually had some things to say, but I'm not exactly sure what it wanted to say. Now, we're going to probably say this with just about every film. There are definitely problematic elements in this film. But I feel like the kind of sex aspect and the nudity, you know, almost like it's got some softcore scenes. I feel like this is that time where Australia just really wanted to feel liberated, and here we want to show boobs, ass, bush, penis, everything on screen. And I feel like they kind of just maybe, you know, came up with the story that kind of fit that, but I don't know. It's hard to say because it feels like it wants to say something. It does feel like it has these deeper kind of themes it wants to explore, but I don't know if it necessarily does. There are certainly moments that I thought worked very well, some that I thought didn't work at all. I feel like it's just me talking, and I think might be a bit more fun to have some more back and forth. Bede.
Well, this well, like I said before, this is my second time watching Alvin Purple. The first time I watched it, again, like Barry McKenzie, was over about 10 odd years ago. At the time, again, like Barry McKenzie, I didn't really think much of it at the time, because to be honest, though, kind of, you know, movies are kind of centered around sex, or at least having that a major factor in its plot. I just don't find that appealing to me as a viewer. Mm-hmm. And this is not me being like a prude or anything like that. It's just any film, whether it's a serious film or like a comedy. Like if it's sort of like one which features a lot of sex, a lot of nudity and stuff like that, where I kind of feel like most of the time that's where the movie kind of focuses on, and story and character become basically secondary. And so I'm not really kind of, it doesn't really hook me in as a whole. Kind of rewatching Alvin Purple, like I definitely appreciate it a little bit more this time around, but like you, like I think it's definitely a film that definitely wants to say something about sex and gender. But at the same time though, I'm not exactly sure what it is, and I feel like it's kind of confused about what it wants to say, and also for the fact that like the script, it feels very scattershot in a lot of ways. So it's like, it feels like it wants to hit a lot of different marks, but it just doesn't, it isn't quite, but it's quite confused about what it wants to do.
Yeah, it does. And I feel like in a way they've kind of set Alvin to be kind of like the opposite of what I guess we tend to see, where it's always men chasing after a woman, and they changed this around to have women be these massive horn bags and kind of trying to mix up the tropes. And I, you know, that's fine, but I don't know if the extremes it was at felt okay, because Alvin in the film, he sort of goes, flashes back, and again, this is like a series of scenes without, doesn't feel like it has much of a kind of a story from beginning to end, if that makes sense. It's not as kind of all over the place as Barry McKenzie. It kind of flows a bit more in terms of trying to tell a story, but blah blah blah. So he flashes back his thinking to when he was 17, or, yeah, 17, I believe, or 16, and all the schoolgirls are basically chasing him, getting angry at each other if they talk to him. It's like absolute pure insanity. And then the wife of his teacher pretty much takes advantage of him and starts, you know, sleeping with him. And to me, that just doesn't feel okay. That really felt iffy to me. I did not like it. I know there wasn't a big age gap, but the fact the character's meant to be that young, and we have seen so many stories in the news of the female teacher like grooming and doing sexual acts with the students, it just makes me feel very iffy.
Yeah.
It didn't get off to the greatest start with that, because I really just felt meh.
Yeah, definitely. I can definitely understand that for sure, because that entire section, like, I did feel uncomfortable watching all this happen. Even though, yeah, it's Graham Blundell playing his character at 16, and they actually do a good job at trying to make him look younger than he does.
Yeah, that's the thing. He did, though. He kind of did look, you know, sort of 17-ish, 18-ish.
Yeah, but it just felt very uncomfortable and weird, and I didn't like it. Although I gotta say, though, during the scenes, because there's a lot of scenes where basically Alvin is trying to escape all these teenage girls who are obsessed with him. And every time he sort of goes to his teacher's wife's house, like he sort of, like she opens up the garage door and he goes flying in. I was just really impressed. And maybe this is just a little thing that, this is just like one of those small things that kind of just buzzed me out. Like in terms of like how impressed it was the timing of that scene, because he's like about the, as the door's swinging up, it looked like there were a bunch of times where the door is about to knock him off his bike.
Yeah.
But like, but I was like thinking like, oh, geez, that was a little too close to call for.
Yeah, and I did actually kind of laugh out loud when, because I was waiting for it. I'm like, he's going to try to go in there and that door's not going to go open and he's going to go smashing into the door.
Yeah.
And when it happened, I did laugh out loud.
Yeah, because it actually set it up that joke really well.
Yeah. Aside from the from the story at the from yeah.
It's kind of one of those things where like after that we basically just follow as, you know, Alvin's a lot older now, and basically it's like all these women are just, he becomes like a waterbed salesman, which did make me laugh because like for a long time my parents actually did own a waterbed. So, because I guess having a waterbed was just the style at the time, that it was like this newfangled thing everyone wanted to get.
Yeah.
So his mates sell waterbeds. And then basically he like goes to all these houses of these women and he basically sets up these waterbeds and all the women just like, hello. And they just basically just want to have sex with him. And it's never, I guess the joke of the film is like this kind of like very normal looking guy who's not like, you know, traditionally handsome in any way. It somehow becomes like this sex symbol and all the women are just insane for him.
Yeah.
Like, it's a major like hunky guy. And I guess maybe that was kind of the joke or the theme the film was going for. But I feel like it kind of doesn't really do much with it other than that kind of setup.
Yeah, it felt too much of like this running gag rather than going in deep with what they wanted to say. Like, do you hate women? Are you just trying to over, you know, do this to kind of show women and Alvin from, you know, the opposite ends? Like, it's so, for me at least, it was so difficult to like kind of understand what they were actually going for. And look, there are sex scenes and some of them I really didn't want to watch. Other ones I kind of found kind of funny, and I think that was the point, like when the waterbed breaks or the paint. But yeah, there is a further one where he sort of doesn't give into the advances of this female therapist, and then she finds out that the other psychiatrist is basically using him as a gigolo. She starts blackmailing him for sex, and at one point she is essentially raping him, and it's just really uncomfortable and not okay. Any kind of scene that is there, almost as if you're supposed to laugh at it, where it is actual rape, it's so uncomfortable. It shouldn't be there. It's not funny.
Yeah, and also there was a scene that I found didn't really work for me as well, is where Alvin Purple has a bit of a run-in with a transgender woman. And that scene, because it sort of ends up being a very transphobic scene, and it just didn't really work for me as well.
It's kind of really horrible. Thankfully the scene doesn't go that long, but no, it's just, it felt very, very mean-spirited, and I didn't like that at all.
Yeah, and for me, those kind of scenes, what we've been talking about, it kind of really sort of knocked the film for me. And a lot of the humor doesn't really quite work as well. And it's not to say there aren't elements about it that I did quite enjoy. I did enjoy the entire third act, which just felt like some kind of very long, almost Benny Hill kind of sketch where basically Alvin Purple is being chased by all the husbands of all the women he had sex with. I mean, all the being chased by all the husbands of the women he had sex with when he was, like, being forced to be a gigolo. And they basically chase after him throughout the whole city, and there's, like, this whole car chase scene, and then he's trying to escape from by a plane, and then he ends up running naked in the streets and being chased by women. Like, it's a pretty outrageous scene, and it actually is quite entertaining. And I guess for me, because I've seen a lot of sort of the sex comedies that came out during the 70s, particularly there's a lot of British ones as well, that were very outrageous in their approach. And I kind of feel like maybe the film probably would have been better if it was a bit more outrageous without trying to have something to say at the same time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like, you know, they could have probably struck a good chord with having, you know, an interesting kind of satirical theme while being very outrageous. But it's kind of in the middle, like, it's kind of goofy but serious, but then goofy. And then it has, you know, that really weird goofy sort of third act, which, you know, it did work really, really well in the film. It just goes all over the place. And the ending, I just kind of shook my head at the ending. I'm like, you know what? That ending is kind of perfect for this film. But there definitely is, you know, some charm. And I know we've said this word a few times, but there is some kind of charm to the character of Alvin at times. And it is elevated by a very, very good performance from Graham Plundell. And, like, I don't think anyone's really complaining about all the boobs and bums we see in this film. They're just all over the place.
Indeed. Although I have to admit, though, there were half the times where for a lot of the how naked a lot of these actors were, from both men to women, where half the time I was like, I could almost see that what that person had for lunch like the week before.
I know. That's like my favorite thing to say is when there's way too much, like, when there's nudity and they're in a position that's, like, very in your face, I like to say, well, you can see what they had for lunch. So.
And I've been saying that line as well, hence why I said it before. But the interesting thing is, like, reading up on it, because, like, the script was originally meant to be sort of half comedic and half serious. And Tim Burstall actually originally envisioned the story as a 20-minute section of a multi-story picture, like a sort of an anthology film, but then he decided to expand it. So maybe that's probably why the film feels very scattershot in terms of its approach to the story.
Yeah, I could actually see, you know, something there with Alvin Purple working as like a 20 to 30 minute segment in an anthology, but maybe having it stretched out this much just, you know, maybe there wasn't just enough meat on the bones to really make it fully work as a film.
Oh, definitely, definitely. But, yeah, I guess, like, for me, I think what makes this film watchable is, of course, like we've said before, Graham Blundell's performance. So for me, he's the highlight of this film. And because of him and the success of this film, because this film actually met when it came out, like, it kind of got mixed reviews, but it was a huge hit at the box office in Australia. It made $4 million, and which I think adjusted in today's money, I think that's like somewhere, I could be completely and utterly wrong, so please forgive me if I am, somewhere in the $30 million range or maybe more in Australia.
Mm.
So this was like Australia's first big major box office smash. And because of that, this was like one of the first Australian films to launch an entire franchise, because it had two sequels with Alvin Rides Again and Melvin, Son of Alvin. And also what a lot of people don't realize is that there was also an Alvin Purple TV series that Graham Blundell came back and reprised the role for.
Yeah. So crazy that this was what kind of took off for like a film series. And we will be talking about the Alvin Purple sequel next month on the Ozbloidcast, so we'll look forward to seeing what we think of the sequel.
indeed. So
after such a good ending, and then it gets a sequel.
I know. But Marcy, what are your final thoughts and rating for Alvin Purple?
I give Alvin Purple 2.5 broken waterbeds out of 5.
Yes.
Look, I think it's a complete mixed bag. And again, if you're curious to see like some of these earlier New Wave films, you know, by all means, check out Alvin Purple. And again, just be aware there's definitely problematic elements. So just be warned when you're going into it. But yeah, I think Graham Blundell does a great job in the role. Beat.
Indeed. And I give it 2.5 as well. I think it what makes this film work is, of course, like I said before, Graham Blundell's performance. To me, he's the heart and soul of the film. And I feel like without him, I don't think the movie would at least be as watchable as it is. Yes. But as a film on its own, I think it's a very mixed bag. There are some aspects that work, some elements of it that don't work at all. But I do. But I think it also does have a bit of a pulse as well due to Tim Burstall's direction, because he gives it that kind of same energy as he did with Stork. Just even though the film, even though the script he has to work with isn't quite on the level as Stork's was. Now, before we get to our next film, a word from our sponsor.
We would like to send a huge thank you to the amazing Podcorn for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. You can check them out at podcorn.com/podcasters. If you, like us, are a podcaster, Podcorn is a fantastic place to check out. You can find amazing sponsorship deals, which links you up to perhaps other podcasts that you can help grow, or products that you actually really love and want to spread the word about. It's an amazing community, and it's been really friendly and such a rewarding experience. There is no middleman. We can browse all the amazing opportunities, or perhaps make one of our own, and we can collaborate with people and brands directly. It's kind of amazing. I highly recommend this. So if, like us, you are a podcast, please check out Podcorn. You can see it in the show notes, or you can go to podcorn.com. And if you are looking to advertise your product, just head to Podcorn as an advertiser. It's freaking amazing. Definitely check it out, guys. And once again, thank you so much to Podcorn. You are amazing. We love and adore you. And now back to the show.
And we are back. We'll move right along to our third film, which of course is the 1973 anthology drama Libido.
There is a drive within us all, that innermost urge, sometimes dangerous, always erotic. They call it libido. It can take you to the edge of ecstasy or the brink of disaster. It is the intimate experience of everyone. The husband mistrusts it.
Harold.
Would you like to have an orgy?
The child discovers it.
Please, Mom. You mustn't think about it like that. You'll understand when you're all grown up.
The priest questions it.
I believe this, Colonel. The Pope has no more authority than Chairman Mao to tell me whether I can marry.
The family man abuses it.
Hey, they're drinking beer.
Yeah?
No, it's good. It shows I've got no affectations.
Right.
And girls that drink beer root like rabbits.
Christ, here comes the counterculture.
Did your wives let you out for the night?
Hey, what would you say if I told you I was single?
I'd say you were a crap artist.
Men, they treat women just like Christmas presents. They only get excited if there's some wrapping to rip off.
I'm as limp as a lettuce.
Jack Thompson, Judy Morris, Jill Forster, and Bruce Barry star in the movie of the year, Libido.
Which features segments directed by John B. Murray, Tim Burstall, again, Fred Skepsi, and David Baker, and with the segments written by, each segment written by Craig McGregor, Hal Porter, Thomas McKinley, and David Williamson. And the film features quite a collective cast. So you've got the likes of Elk Neidhart, Judy Morris, Robin Nevin, Penny Hackford-Jones, who was also in Alvin Purple as well, and Arthur Diggum, and also Jack Thompson as well. And Marcy, what is the plot summary for Libido?
All right, back on Letterboxd. A film quartet about the erotic drive within us all. Scripted by four of Australia's greatest authors, David Williamson, Thomas Kennelly, Hal Porter, and Craig McGregor, the Quartet of Carnal Desires explores adultery and jealous fantasies, the end of innocence, the moral and spiritual conflicts of a priest and nun in love. The stories define the exploration of women and the cultural upheaval of the early 70s.
Indeed. And I'd sort of give a bit of a backstory. Since this is an anthology drama, I should state, even though I mentioned who wrote and directed this film before, I will say, like, which segments these creators were a part of. The Husband was directed by John B. Murray and written by Craig McGregor. The Child was directed by Tim Burstall and Hal Porter. The Priest, directed by Fred Skepsy, which I believe might have been Fred Skepsy's directorial debut as well. Let me just confirm that. Indeed, it was.
There you go.
And also, finally, the fourth story, The Family Man, was directed by David Baker and written by David Williamson, who also wrote Stalk. So, Marcy, what did you think of Libido?
All right. So, I hadn't really heard of this film until we were planning this podcast. And I'm like, why is Australia obsessed with all these sex movies? I actually had no idea that Libido was A, an anthology, and B, more of like a drama than anything. So that was quite surprising. I sat down and, yeah, I went to watch this film. So the first segment is it's very weird, but I think it's almost clever in a way with sort of how it tells this story, where you can see that the husband is very jealous. He's having this very weird, maybe kind of a midlife crisis thing. He, you know, suspects maybe his wife's having an affair with a friend, and then he has like this weird, I don't know, dream fantasy where she's basically getting gangbanged by a bunch of random men, almost kind of like Eyes Wide Shut in a way. And it's the weirdest scene I've ever seen. Well, maybe not the weirdest, but it is this very kind of psychedelic, just a weird scene. And then you sort of follow this story with this husband, and I'm not quite sure what the hell's going on with the husband, but then, as every segment in this, it has this kind of bit of a messed up ending, like, oh, really? It's going there. Okay, shit. But yeah, what did you think of the first segment? We'll go segment by segment for this
one. Yeah, I think that's a good idea. And I think for me, the husband was the weakest segment of the four. Like, I can definitely see what is going for, especially since it's sort of a more the most comical of the four stories.
Yeah.
And also having this husband who basically is sort of wondering, like, is his wife having an affair with his friend or not, and him trying to sort of find out and it kind of plays up with his mind, because a lot of what happens is things that he think is like how he envisions everything happening in his imagination, hence the really weird, bizarre orgy scene that you mentioned. But I just don't feel like it really works as a whole. I mean, the acting isn't that great, and as weird as it is, I guess out of all the four segments, this is definitely the most exploitation of the four, and probably one of the reasons why people put it on exploitation lists to begin with. But I don't know, it just didn't really work for me. I don't think the writing was all that good. It's well directed, but yeah, I just didn't feel like this whole segment really worked. And where it goes at the end is kind of like, okay, whatever. It's like very predictable. So
it's definitely a weird one. I don't know if it entirely worked. This segment is called The Husband, but we'll move on to the next segment, which I think is called The Child.
Indeed. And what's interesting is, again, we talked about Tim Burstall directing this one, but unlike, say, Stalk and Album Purple, this one's actually a period piece. So, and what did you think of this one?
This one was, for me, it was very weird, but I get what they were going for because it is kind of like this end of innocence thing. It's a young boy kind of hitting the end of childhood. So this boy, I believe he gets a new sort of like nanny because his mum goes away, I think.
Yeah, she goes away with her. Yeah, she kind of goes away with her new beau because the boy, Martin, played by John Williams, his father, I will admit, even though it's meant to be played serious, I did laugh because you find out that his dad went away and he died, but he died in the sinking of the Titanic.
Oh, God.
Which I will admit, it's like, okay, that's, even though, yeah, it probably wasn't silly at the time, but in hindsight, it just feels very silly, at least that sort of finding out about, and of course, his mum kind of, like, is lonely for a bit, but then she sort of finds somebody else to love, which I believe is the character of David, played by Bruce Barry.
Yeah, so he gets a nanny to, well, she gets a nanny to look after him, and the boy kind of starts falling in love with the nanny, and everything kind of unravels when the mum's back and then he sees something going on with the nanny and takes a very dark turn in this film. And I guess if you haven't seen Libido, which I'm sure most of you probably haven't, here's your spoiler warning. So you can fast forward a little bit if you don't want to know what happens. But yes, he sees the nanny getting fucked, and he goes to run away. They chase him, and then the man goes to try and get the boy out of the boat, but then he, you know, tricks him and he starts rowing his boat. The man falls in the water, he can't swim, and drowns.
Indeed. And we did put a spoiler warning at the beginning of this episode, so but I have to admit, I actually really did like this segment because I kind of see, like, for me, I guess what I responded to, like, even though it's like weird that this young boy is kind of pining for his nanny, who's played by Judy Morris, like, it does feel very weird. But at the same time, though, I kind of see it as like this boy who is so lonely because like he kind of got probably attention from his father and then he dies.
Yeah.
And then, of course, like his relationship with his mother is fractured because she goes off and finds someone else and he has no one, so he kind of latches on to the nanny, who's the only one who actually shows some kind of affection and love for him. And the fact that this this beau of his of the mother's basically has an affair with the nanny really kind of turns his world upside down. And I think it's actually like sort of interesting, sort of Tim Burstall directing this segment, because I thought it was actually pretty well done overall, and it's interesting to kind of see a different side of Tim Burstall doing a straight up drama.
Yeah, definitely, it is an interesting, you know, very different film that we've seen so far from Tim Burstall. And yeah, it is definitely, you know, about a very lonely boy who, it's, you know, he is growing up and it is this end of his own innocence, and he's basically murdered the man that his mum was with and then decided to start fucking the nanny. So it's a bit fucked up. Indeed, gotta give the movie credit for going that dark.
I know, it's just so off, like, it, I gotta appreciate the film for actually doing that.
Definitely. The next segment is called The Priest. So what did I think of this one? I actually thought this one was really, really interesting. This is very kind of a dramatic and very dialogue heavy piece, but you can kind of see this inner struggle between the priest and the nun. And I think it's almost like this very, I'm trying to think of the right words. It's almost, I guess, in a way, like this deconstruction of the Catholic Church. Very, very sort of hard hitting with what it has to say. It's very kind of, so it's kind of like this almost scathing look at the church with what he has to say. But what did you think of the priest?
I think this segment for me is the best of the four. What I really liked about this segment and the way that it's acted, written, and directed, it kind of reminded me of an Ingmar Bergman film.
Mm.
And it does have a lot to say, sort of like the Catholic Church, in terms of like when it comes to like what priests and nuns go through with their vow of celibacy and what happens when a priest and a nun actually legit fall in love and how does it affect them both as people and also as people of faith, and particularly ones who have dedicated their lives in service of God. And it's interesting kind of seeing different points of view from both the actors, the priest, Father Byrne, being played by Arthur Dignam, and the nun, Sister Caroline, played by Robin Nevin, who I guess for most people who want to know who she's most recently starred in the film Relic as the grandmother, so that's where most people would know her like from her recent work. So this was one of her earliest roles. And I think it's interesting kind of seeing both of them, because he's kind of at that thing where he, even though he was a very dedicated priest who was very in touch with his faith, but as soon as he fell in love, he knows kind of like what will happen. So he's willing to kind of throw everything away, like his priesthood, the church, his faith and all that, to be with this woman. But Sister Caroline, on the other hand, she wants to be with him, but at the same time, she wants to still hold on to her faith. And even if they get married, to still get married in church. So it's kind of interesting seeing these two kind of conflicting ideas while trying to like find a solution for how they continue with their love. But at the same time, though, there's a complexity to it and there's no easy answers. And I think both sides kind of show like, you know, give good points to what they want to do. And to me, I just found this whole segment just so fascinating as a whole.
I agree. I think this is probably maybe the most interesting one. And it's not one that's more kind of exploitative in nature. It takes this very kind of philosophical approach while also kind of condemning the church in a way. That's what I've kind of felt from it. It definitely makes you think. And I thought both performances were very, very strong. And an absolutely just very interesting piece. If you do want to see Libido and track it down, definitely get to this segment, because I just think it's really, really interesting and quite different than what we've seen so far.
Indeed. And I think it's such a strong little debut for Fred Skepsi as a director. For those out there, like his next film up is, he would actually still go down the path of the Catholic Church when he directed The Devil's Playground, which is such a fantastic film. If anyone hasn't seen it, definitely seek it out. But he, like I said, has had such quite a career in both Australia and Hollywood, because he would make films such as like The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, Iceman, Roxanne, Evil Angels, aka A Cry in the Dark, the movie that most people probably know as where Meryl Streep plays Lindsay Chamberlain and shouting, "A dingo stole me, baby." And also IQ. So, and like, he's had such a quite an interesting career, but it's interesting to see like how strong of a director he was based just on this segment alone.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very interesting to kind of see these beginnings for him. So yeah, a very, very interesting one. The final segment, I believe, is called The Family Man, and this one has Jack Thompson in the lead.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this one, I actually found this one to be really, really interesting as well. And I thought, like, as disgusting of a character that Jack Thompson plays, I felt his performance was really, really, really strong. Very kind of what a good actor kind of moment. So this one kind of focuses on a family man. His wife is having another baby, and he calls up his mate. They go get drunk. They bring women back to the house, and it gets very, very disgusting and abusive. But it's something that they don't entirely get away with, which that really took me by surprise. But at the same time, the wife's reaction to it, the hell did you not just take your kids and fuck off?
Indeed.
I think one of those, like, okay, we know that they've been outed for what they are, but the wife is still going to stay. Sorry, and I cut you off. I forgot.
Oh, no, that's all right. I was just waiting for you to finish.
Okay. But that's what I said.
Yeah, well, I think it's an interesting segment as well. Like, it's kind of interesting because David Williamson is such a... I mean, I've seen quite a lot of his previous work as a writer for the screen. But interesting kind of rewatching or seeing for the first time a lot of his work, like in terms of like what we've been covering for the Osborne cast so far, between this and also Stalk, and also the next film we're going to talk about, Peterson, which he also wrote, just how interesting of a writer he is and how he sort of explores specific topics and themes. And he's definitely someone who definitely has a lot of interesting things to say about gender politics as well, and sort of the relationships between men and women. But he also finds that there's a lot of complexity to these characters, and there's a lot more sort of facets to them that make them more kind of interesting as characters rather than sort of black and white kind of characters. And for me, this segment I did find really interesting. And also the performances are pretty solid throughout. And you are definitely fearful of the women who are played by Debbie Nurkiewicz and Suzanne Brady. You do feel like fear for these women because you honestly don't know these two guys, Ken and Gerald, played by Jack Thompson and Max Gillies. Like, you don't know how they're going to handle the situation, even though they're both family men. It's just the way that they like, even though like Gerald's wife is giving birth at the same time all of this is happening, like he's going out like wanting to like have sex, you know, with another woman, and Ken is basically like egging him on and everything, and it's kind of just shows just how disgusting these characters are who are supposed to be, you know, family men as well.
Absolutely. They're just disgusting. They really are. And you can see just how much like one is egging on the other. And, you know, it leads to, you know, almost practically, you know, rape happening. But, you know, they definitely sexually assaulted these women, and they're very raw and confronting scenes that are hard to watch. But, you know, towards the end, when he kind of is coming home with his wife and the women have left this big banner up saying, you know, these men are, you know, sexual abusers, and the wife is just like, well, clean it up. And it's like, you just kind of feel sad that she's hasn't kicked him in the nuts and taken off. Even though he's outed as a fucking sexual abuser, you know, his wife is still there. And that kind of just was like, oh, fucking stop ending these movies like this.
Definitely.
But I think overall, though, Libido is quite an interesting film. Not at all what I was expecting. Definitely recommend it. I think there's a lot of interesting things in there. So I guess my rating and final thoughts, I give it 3 out of 5 priests lusting after nuns. And yeah, I was very surprised. A lot of interesting things in there. So yeah, what about yourself?
I give it 3 out of 5 as well. I'm agreeing way too much tonight. I'm not.
I know, it's weird, right?
I know. Like, I would say the two, like, even though I think, or like, I would say definitely The Child and The Priest are definitely the best segments for me. And I think The Family Man is still a pretty solid segment with, you know, the husband being kind of the worst one. But I think overall, it's a pretty solid anthology with a lot of interesting things to say about love, sex, and relationships, and particularly gender politics as well. But before we sort of wrap up our conversation on this film, this film actually did win the Australian Film Institute Award for Best Picture. But would you believe me, Marcy, if I told you it wasn't for the whole film, but only for one of the segments?
Oh.
It was actually The Child that won the award.
Oh wow. I actually had no idea.
And Judy Morris actually won Best Actress for her performance as the nanny in this.
Oh, wow. Okay.
As well. And also, Judy Morris, we'll be talking about her a lot in future episodes of the Osploit cast, because she was also in Razorback and a bunch of other movies as well. Mm-hmm. But she kind of quit acting and became a writer, and she would go on to write both, or co-write, I should say, Babe, Pig in the City and Happy Feet.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So she's had quite an interesting career. So
definitely.
But and also the pre-segment was written by Tom McKinley, who also wrote the book that the film Schindler's List was based on. So
there you go.
Indeed. But now moving on to our fourth film for this episode, which of course is the horror comedy The Cars That Ate Paris.
Hospitals all over the country, all over the world. Accident. But that's the world we live in. That's the world of the motor car. You gotta listen to me. Now you get this into your mind. Nobody leaves Paris. No one.
Which was co-written and directed by, actually written and directed, I should say, by Peter Weir, who, of course, is one of Australia's most legendary and directors, from a story by Peter Weir, Keith Gow, and Piers Davies. And this film stars John Mellion, Terry Camilleri, I probably butchered his last name, so please forgive me, Chris Haywood and Bruce Spence, and also Max Gillies is also in this film as well. And Marcy, what is the plot summary for The Cars That Ate Paris?
Okay, so I'm going on Letterboxd. 148 people live in the township of Paris, and every one of them is a murderer. After the death of his brother on the road, unemployed and unstable drifter Arthur Waldo stays for a while in the rural Australian town of Paris as the guest of the mayor, who hopes he will become a permanent member of the Paris population. Arthur soon realizes the quaint hamlet has a sinister secret. They orchestrate car accidents and rob the victims. Survivors are brought to the local hospital, lobotomized, and used for the doctor's experiments.
Now, like Barry McKenzie and Alvin Purple, I have seen The Cars That Ate Paris before. But, Marcy, I'm curious to hear what you think of this film, because this film was Peter Weir's second film as director. And it's such a stark contrast between every other film that he would make after this, since, you know, he is a multi-Oscar nominated Aussie director. So what did you think of this very early work from him as a filmmaker?
Yeah, I knew this was one of the first things that he had done. So I was definitely curious to check it out. And it is very, very different to anything else he's done. Like, whoa. But I think overall, the film, for me, at least watching it, it's a bit of a mixed bag. I felt like the kind of story and idea with it, I think, was really interesting and definitely very kind of creepy. Like, this town kind of causing accidents to rob the victims. Like, that's fucked up, right? Mm. But then there's kind of this inner struggle between, you know, the town folk, like the older folk and the younger folk. And that kind of took me out of it a little bit. Because considering what they're doing, you'd think everyone in the town would get along, but I guess there kind of needed to be some conflict. I thought the performances were actually pretty solid. I've got to go back on the cast list. I felt that Terry Camilleri was actually really, really good in the way that he portrayed Arthur, and John Millian was really, really good as well. It's a shame Bruce Spence had such a small role, because he just had such a striking look in this film, and I just wanted to see more of him. But yeah, this film kind of makes you not want to get stuck anywhere in any rural town, much like Wake in Fright does. Because who knows what the people are like there.
Indeed.
But I will say, at least as we get into the final act of the film, the stunts and the cast off, it's absolutely incredible to watch. And that sort of, you know, beetle car with all the spikes that's on the poster, seeing that in the film is epic. So this does, it is a slow burn, which is fine. And it leads to this really great kind of conclusion in a way. But I did feel it was a mixed bag. What did you think of the cars that ate Paris?
Well, like Barry and Alvin, I've seen the Cars That Ate Paris many, many years ago, and I'm a huge Peter Weir fan. I think he's probably the greatest filmmaker that has ever come out of Australia. Like, he's made so many fantastic films, you know, like Picnic at Hanging Rock, Gallipoli, Green Card, Dead Poets Society, The Truman Show. Like, he is a man who has made so many brilliant films. So when I first heard about this film, I was curious to kind of see, the fact that he made a horror comedy just kind of boggles my mind a little bit, because horror comedy is not what I associate Peter Weir with at all.
And
I
no.
I guess the closest to a horror film he's ever come to is, well, at least for me at the time, you know, of the films I've seen, was probably Picnic and Hanging Rock. So I was kind of curious to see what I would think of Cars That Ate Paris. And at the time, I really didn't like it, to be honest. And now, having rewatched it again, I still don't like it. And I guess my main problem with this film is it's a film that is brimming with so many ideas, but it just doesn't have a narrative to support it. Like, it just feels like there's ideas, but they don't feel fleshed out enough to feel fully developed as a story. And it just feels like this random stuff is just happening throughout this whole film. And even though, the film never really sort of dives into the motivations of why this town does this, like, causes car accidents to people, and why the local youths kind of build all these cars to, like, these sort of monstrosities that feel very pre Mad Max in a lot of ways.
Very pre-Mad Max.
And understandably so, because apparently this film was also an influence on the Mad Max franchise, because, like, I know this film actually kicked off the trend in Australian film where there was sort of the car-centric Aussie film. After this film, there'll be so many other sort of car-centric Aussie films, and a lot we will definitely be talking about on this show in the future. And also, to show how much this film was a huge influence on the Mad Max franchise, the most recent entry, Fury Road, actually has a car in it that looks exactly like the Beetle with spikes that we were that you were talking about before. So it's definitely not a coincidence at all.
Yeah.
But I guess for me, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interesting elements to it. Like the design of the cars is really cool, but some of the performances are pretty solid. I did like John Melian as the mayor. And, like, watching his performance, I was looking at it thinking, like, where have I seen this guy before? And I looked him up, like, as I was watching the film for a quick moment, and I realized we have actually talked about two films that he had starred in on this podcast previously, because he played Charlie the Barman in the town of Timbunda in Wake and Fright, like the scene at the very beginning. And he also played the dad who tried to murder the kids in Walkabout.
Yep.
And I think your mind was blown when I told you that revelation.
Yeah, because I was watching it and I'm like, he looks so familiar. Yeah, I'm like, he looks familiar, but I was like, yeah. I'm watching this movie and then before I had actually bothered to look it up, you told me. I was like, oh, shit, okay, that makes sense.
But speaking of that, though, like looking up like on sort of the history and trivia of this film, do you know there was also another Wake and Fright actor was originally meant to play his character before he got cast?
Oh, and who was that?
Donald Pleasance was originally going to play the character. He was in talks for the film and he really liked the script, but they couldn't agree, but it just fell through. I think it might have had something to do with his fee to get him to be a part of it. So they cast John Melian at the last minute in the role. And I think he does a pretty solid job in the role. Terry Camilleri, I was kind of mixed on because I get what his character's meant to be, this character who was kind of like survived this car accident where his brother was killed. And he's also dealing with the fact that, you know, trauma for accidentally killing someone the year before in his car, which he, you know, because, and he was almost charged with manslaughter, but he was acquitted, but, you know, he was never allowed to drive again. So I sympathize with his struggle throughout this whole film, but I guess I found, I don't know, the performance itself just didn't really work for me for some reason. And I guess I found him just too meek and weak of a character to really kind of be engaged by. But I think Bruce Haywood, who plays Daryl, the kind of the leader of the sort of the young youths who run this town, I thought he was quite good. And even though Bruce Spence only has a smaller role in this film, I thought he was quite memorable regardless. And he kind of does steal every scene he was in. And also, like, this film, what's interesting is, like, this film actually had quite a controversy at the time it was released.
Oh, really?
Due to the violent nature of the film.
Oh.
And because it got a lot of outrage from people. But I can understand. I mean, I guess it's really more tame by today's standards now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can definitely see why they would. Because, like, that last half for me is what makes the film. Because it's just such a balls out, insane little sequence where these cars just go in. Like, these hoodlums sort of drive these cars around town and destroy everything.
Yeah, it just goes fucking balls to the walls nuts.
Indeed. And but that being said, though, it just feels like, I think this is even more scattershot than Album Purple, because, like I said, it's a film that's full of ideas but just never really finds a narrative to support these ideas. I feel like it's more interested in the ideas than it is the story.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It feels like that. It almost feels like half a film.
Yeah.
In a way. But we'll wrap this up with scores. So I give this film 2.5 spiked beetle cars out of 5. And, yeah, worth watching, you know, as a curiosity to see early works of Peter Weir. And for that, you know, sort of last bit of the film where it just goes absolutely crazy. What about you, Bede?
I think for me, I think we're finally going to differ slightly in terms of our ratings. I'm going to give this about 2 stars out of 5. Like I said, there's a lot of interesting elements to it, but I feel like it's a film that's more, I guess for me, this film is kind of like the old saying goes, where the sums of the parts are better than the actual whole. So Yeah, like I said, it's an interesting kind of curiosity, like you said, to see a very early work from Peter Weir. It would be interesting to kind of see what his career would have been like if he went down this more kind of crazy film kind of route. But but for me, yeah, it just didn't really work as either a horror film or as a comedy or even a satire for me as well.
Yeah.
Although I will say this, though, I'll give it credit. Like, the first half of the movie, I was, like, watching the first half where we see this couple who get killed and put in a car accident. Like, the way that whole section was staged, I'm just sitting there going, like, why does this feel like a TV commercial? But then I found out, with all the product placement and all that, but apparently I was reading up, that was all deliberate. They wanted it to be a satire on commercials at the time.
Oh, wow. Very
so, cool. Although I had to laugh when the car crashed. And they had a dog with them, and you could obviously see, like, the fake dog just go flying out of the car.
I know, bloody hell. Well, they better list the car that ate Paris on the website, does the dog die?
Indeed. Although I like the fact that it's kind of misleading. In other parts of the world, this film was known as The Cars That Eat People.
Yeah, so. I did see that, and I'm like, no.
Yeah,
doesn't work. No.
Definitely does not. But
all right.
So we'll move right along to our fifth and final film, which of course is the 1974 drama Peterson.
Meet Tony Peterson.
What's your name?
Hard drinking.
Yes, sir. Think you're above the law or something?
Hard driving.
The size of the street you came out of, you fucking idiot. This is a main highway.
It's got nothing to do with it. I had the right of way. Now the law says.
I don't give a stuff what the law says, fella. Use your...
No nonsense.
I feel like a fucking idiot.
You look like one, too. We got out.
She's taken back for questioning. And all mad.
Oh, man. You got excited. You'll be able to do it. Feels like it.
Right. Oh, God. Acclaimed Australian writer David Williamson joins with Tim Burstall, the maker of Alvin Purple, to bring you a raw, uncompromising study of a vanishing breed in today's society. A man who makes his own rules.
I've been offered this sort of deal by every little pushy businessman in the city. Shoving up your ass.
Peterson mends fuses for a living. But he goes to university. Peterson is married, but you wouldn't notice. Peterson never says no to a woman or a fight.
How would you like to get your head knocked in?
Jack Thompson is Peterson.
Which was directed by... Oh, look who it is, Tim Burstall.
Oh, what a surprise.
Indeed. And written by David Williamson. So this is them re-teaming after Stork.
Mm-hmm.
And the film stars Jack Thompson, Jackie Weaver, Wendy Hughes, which I believe was her film acting debut.
Yep.
Belinda Giblin, Arthur Dingham, and Charles Budd Tigwell as well. Mm. And Marcy, what is the plot summary for Peterson?
All right, back to the old Letterboxd. When he wasn't fighting, he was getting in other trouble. Tony Peterson, a married electrician and ex-footballer, goes to university to study English. Peterson is the odd man out at uni. He receives extracurricular extracurricular help from his stuffy professor's beautiful lecturer wife in her office. Their get-togethers are quite routine. The professor is also seeing one of his students after class. Peterson and the professor's wife talk about having a baby, but then she accepts an appointment to Oxford, provoking a rage in Peterson. Now, I apologize as that synopsis was not written in the best English, so I had to kind of fix it as I was talking. So Peterson is the first lead feature for Jack Thompson. And I believe this is a film that kind of really kick-started and made him a very big star.
Indeed. Like, this, like, up to this point, because he'd only had, like, small roles in films. Like, we've already talked about him in both Wake and Fright and, of course, like, just a few films ago with Libido. So this was, like, one of his first big major lead roles, which he won the Australian Film Institute Award for Best Actor for his performance in this film, along with his performance in another classic Australian film, Someday Too Far Away. So he kind of won for both films. But this was the film that launched Jack Thompson internationally. Not made him a huge star in Australia, but also made him very, like, one to watch, like, for a lot of international audiences as well.
Mm.
So this was both mine and yours first time watching it. What did you think of Peterson?
Well, out of all the films we've spoken about for this episode, I think Peterson is the one that I perhaps liked the most and maybe got the most out of. And I thought it was maybe the best made film. It is very much the Jack Thompson vehicle. He is just, wow, he's so good as Peterson. Like, he can play this drunken asshole character. But what I find interesting is that this film is definitely this character study, and it doesn't hold back. It shows this character in this very raw way where, you know, there are many very unlikable aspects, but there's also parts that you kind of understand, which I found very interesting, because it's not the sort of character you might sympathize with or have empathy for. And he does, you know, this character does go on this kind of self-destruction throughout this film. And he does make some very bad decisions that make it very hard to kind of get behind him. But it definitely has some interesting things to say. And it is quite complicated where you've got, you know, he's married, him and his wife have kids, but he's also, you know, having this affair with the professor's wife. And the professor is played by the priest from Libido. So we've got more character, you know, more of the same actors showing up. And meanwhile, you know, obviously the professor and the wife are not in a, you know, very great relationship, as he's, you know, having sex with one of his students as well. But it's hard to sort of understand but you can see that Peterson himself is really looking for something more in life. And this is him trying to get it, but going about it the wrong way. Like, I feel like deep down he knows that he's probably going to be stuck in this position no matter how much he wants to leave it, because he keeps making the same decisions. But there's definitely a little bit of disjointedness to the film. There's this scene where they're at, is it the student that he's having the affair with, the professor? It's her birthday?
I think it was like,
One of the friends or something?
Yeah, one of the friends. Like, one of their friends, one of Peterson's female friends at school, like, she's getting married to a car dealership owner, a car salesman. And then, of course, they go to their sort of engagement party.
I thought it was her birthday.
It might have been her birthday.
Because the cake had candles.
It might have been, yeah, you might be right, so.
Yeah, but it's like, she's obviously a student, because, like, the students there, but also the professors are there.
Mm.
It's very weird, but, yeah, so there's this party at her house, and for some reason, it's never explained, these bikies show up, they say they know Peterson, we don't know who they are, why they're there. And they just come in and they start fucking everything up. It looks like they want to rape the birthday girl, until Peterson comes in and just starts bashing the shit out of him. And then it's never addressed again.
Indeed.
that whole sequence, I was like, what is this? It really took me out of the film, because it's kind of like one of the only things that doesn't make sense. And it kind of just added to this weird disjointedness to some of the scenes. Yeah. But overall, I actually thought this was a really, really strong film, and definitely very compelling watch. And this very, you know, this character study of this man who is pretty much just descending into his own madness in a way. What did you think of Peterson?
I really liked this film as well, and I think I was really kind of surprised about the complexity about it and how layered it is. Like, there's definitely a lot of exploitation elements to it, like the scene we talked about with the bikers, but also the kind of really the scene where Tony Peterson, played by Jack Thompson, he and his mate kind of randomly go into this one class where it's full of women. And they sort of, like, the women there are talking about how, I believe there was a woman who was put in jail for reasons that she shouldn't have been put into jail for. Oh, I remember what it is, for having sex in public. For
life. Yes, I was going to say.
So basically one of the students there decides, like, oh, well, I'm just going to basically, like, form a protest by having sex with some random person in public. And so she chooses Peterson to be the partner, and he willingly goes for it, even though he has like the worst disguise in the history of disguises, which is so, like, that whole sequence feels like out of, like, and they do have sex in public, but it feels like it's out of a completely different film. Like, it feels like it could belong in Alvin Purple more than anything else. Sorry, a bit of cough there. But outside of that, there's a lot of interesting things in terms of, like, Peterson's relationships with his wife, played by Jackie Weaver, and, like you said, the Wendy Hughes' character, Trish Kent, like, and sort of like his and his affair with her, but also, like, how much, like, even though he's a complete asshole, like, you can honestly understand why he's doing what he's doing, and also for the fact that, like, this is a guy who used to be a major football star. He no longer is anymore and is now working as an electrician. And he does want to try to better himself because I think he wants to sort of get out of the situation he is. But it seems like due to circumstances that happen through the story, it's like, I guess, more civilized. Sort of like the university and others that he knows are trying to stop in some way, kind of deliberate. Like, from his point of view, kind of he feels like they're kind of stopping him from reaching his full potential, and they kind of see him as, in a way, as no more than lower life. And then, of course, that leads Peterson down to some very troubling directions. And basically he gets to a point where he feels like, well, if this is what I'm supposed to be, then, you know what, so be it. So it's very interesting kind of seeing his journey throughout the whole film, and you do feel very sort of conflicted about him as a character, because at times you're like, oh yeah, I can understand, like, what he means in here, but then other times you're like, oh no.
Yeah, it's like, what the fuck are you doing, mate?
Indeed.
Don't work through this. You're being a dickhead.
Exactly. And there's also a very, I guess we need to talk about this scene very briefly, because it is probably the most controversial scene in the film, and one that, even at the time when this film was released, drew a lot of controversy. And slight bit of spoiler warning, and also trigger warning as well, is when he just, out of, like, anger, decides to rape Trish. So that whole scene, like, is very full on. And then afterwards, you never really see, like, we never see Trish again after that. And we never see, like, any sort of comeuppance that he gets from that. So
And that whole scene, like, she's given him the news that she'll be going to Oxford, and he pretty much loses his shit. He starts getting so rough with her. And this is a point of this character that you can see he's feeling any kind of power he had in his life slipping away. So him assaulting her is this man clinging to any sort of power. And look, I don't think it's quite too gratuitous. It is a difficult scene to watch, and I don't condone, you know, scenes like this for the sake of it. There are definitely other ways you can do it without showing something, but that's what it's representing, and that he is going through this, doing something so fucking horrible, And I feel like he's resigned to, yep, I've got, you know, this gorgeous but boring wife, a shitty job. I'm not going to make a lot of money or amount to anything after, you know, he was a football star. And then, you know, the ending for him is he continues on with what he's fucking doing. And as an electrician, he's just fucking random women.
Yeah.
And it does make you feel disgusted that there's no comeuppance. But maybe the comeuppance is that he's never going to amount to anything else in life.
Yeah, I actually do agree with that, because that's the time when I watched this film. And like you said, like the grape scene, even though it is very hard to watch, isn't full on gratuitous. Like, I think David Williamson and Tim Burstall definitely used that scene as a point for what they would try with their story. Like, it's just, it's there, it's, there's a specific reason why that's there. And I think what you said makes a lot of sense. And actually, now thinking about it, actually makes that, like, what comes afterwards, like, even better. Because, like you said, like, basically at this point, like, he, like, he's basically now, like, he's basically a character who wants to be better, sees himself as better as everyone else. I mean, there's a moment in the film where he actually does call his wife dumb as well. And basically she seems oblivious to all the shit that he's up to, because, like, she literally catches him with another friend's wife. And she's, like, not upset or angry or anything about it. So basically, like, you know, he feels like, oh, he's better than everyone and all that. But then now that he's deprived of that sort of, you know, that sort of that thing that he wants and has to resign to the way that he is now, like, he's basically, like, more content with it now. And I guess, you know, in a way, like, he probably thinks, like, shrugs it off as no big deal. But at the end of the day, like, you're just never going to, we as an audience see, like, oh, this man is never going to amount to anything. And the only thing, like, he's going to basically, like he'll probably, like you say, still sleep around with women and all that. But he's going to be, like, one of those people, like, this has been football star who basically tries to coax women to sleeping with him by spouting Shakespeare, because he knows has a bit of an English degree now. So I guess in a way, that's kind of a little bit of a revenge and also a comeuppance to what he did to Trish.
Yeah, and the way it handles, you know, Jackie Weaver's character of the wife, she is like just this submissive housewife. Like, it is, it's a very sad character that she just seems so almost just, she's resigned to the fact that this is her life. Her husband does these things. And you see those little bits of frustrations where she does talk about, you know, she's sick of being poor and such and such, but then she's quickly shut down. And she's someone who just doesn't find her voice. And I kind of almost find that a bit disappointing that we didn't get more from this character. But again, the film's focus is Peterson.
Indeed. But I do appreciate that at least David Williamson actually at least sort of gives a bit more dimension to the female characters, because, like, probably films at this time probably wouldn't, but I like the fact that he at least, even if they're not the main focus of the story, but he at least fleshes them out so they feel three-dimensional as characters rather than just being the stock, you know, wife or the stock, you know, you know, girlfriend on the side kind of characters. Yeah.
I think we definitely got more from the character of Trish, which, you know, it was a very, very, you know, solid performance as well.
Oh, definitely. And Wendy Hughes did a really good job with it as well. And, yeah, but at the end of the day, it really is Jack Thompson's performance. And at times, even watching his performance, it did remind me a lot of, like, Marlon Brando's early work, particularly in A Streetcar Named Desire. Like, this sort of rough and tumble kind of character, like Stanley Kowalski. But he but you can definitely see why people would be find him appealing and want to be around this person, even though he does a lot of horrible things.
Yeah, there's a lot of charisma there. And there's this weird charm that the man has, but then you definitely see that uglier side as well. Yeah, and to note, if anybody wants to see all of Jackie Weaver, this is the film for you.
Indeed. Like, let's just say, like, you see one part of Jackie Weaver on full display on the big screen. Like, it literally takes up the whole screen.
It does. but yes, we'll do final ratings and we'll do our ratings and final thoughts. So I gave Peterson 3.5. What the fuck is up with the bikies at this party out of 5? obviously the film comes with, you know, a content trigger warning because of some of the scenes and themes in the film, but definitely one to check out. It's an interesting piece of Australian cinema, that's for sure.
Indeed. And also we're back in agreement. I give it 3.5 as well. I was definitely very surprised by this film, and it's also like The Child, kind of seeing a different side of Tim Burstall as a filmmaker. Especially like after watching two comedies and now seeing two kind of more serious works of his as well. And I think he did a really good job directing wise. It's well written, and also the performance is all strong. But at the end of the day, it's a very sort of complex film that has a lot of interesting themes it tackles, while also giving up definitely a star-making performance from Jack Thompson. I mean, so much so that Stanley Kubrick himself was a huge fan of Jack Thompson's performance in this film.
There you go.
But that'll be a wrap on this third episode of the Ozploid cast.
Yes.
I hope all of our listeners enjoyed it. And thank you also, once again, Marcy, for being a great co-host.
Thank you very much. And thank you to all our listeners, new and old. We very much appreciate it and hope that you get a little more insight into Australian cinema and the Ozploit films, that there are so many different, all sorts of different genres, but a lot of the same actors and crew. So it's very, very interesting. But of course, and you can find the Super Network at our base of operations at supermarcy.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/supermarcy. You can follow the Super Network's Twitter at @SM_supernetwork. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesupernetwork. And you can join the Super Network's Facebook group, which you can find under the Super Network on the Facebook groups. We are also on YouTube under the Super Networks, or you can look up Super Marcy or Beach of Mine and you should find our channel. You can subscribe to that and check out the bonus like video content that we do there. You can follow our Instagram at the.super.network, and you can find us on TikTok at the Super Network. And of course, if you want early access, ad-free podcasts, video exclusives, all sorts of incredible and amazing stuff, including a Patreon exclusive podcast called After Dark with Super Marcy, you can head to our Patreon at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Bede, where can people find you online?
Now, people want to find me personally. They can find me at my Twitter page at twitter.com/BeeJamine, or my personal writer's page on Facebook at facebook.com/TerribleAussie. And, of course, you can find all my writings over at supermarcy.com with my reviews and columns.
Yes, absolutely. So, guys, thank you so much for tuning in to the Ozploit cast. It is an absolute pleasure to bring everybody this podcast. So Bede, that's a wrap. We're done.
Indeed. And but we will be back with the Ozploit cast in August, in which we will return to the worlds of both Alvin Purple and Barry McKenzie, where we will be discussing their sequels, Barry McKenzie Holds His Own and Alvin Rides Again, and as well as three other films, which will be Stone, The Love Epidemic, and Sidecar Racer.
There we go. So some very interesting ones coming up. And yeah, so until next time, I've been super, Bede's been terrible, And maybe don't chunder on the Fosters.
Maybe you should chunder on the Fosters because, you know, Fosters is terrible.
Yeah, we haven't the Fosters to chunder in the first place. So there you go.
Exactly.
You're going to chunder, chunder on something else, mate.
Exactly. Exactly.
Catch you later, everyone.
See you, everybody. Bye.
Turn around once and we'll do the eagle run.
Super Network is proudly sponsored by Surfshark VPN.
Why would you have a VPN in this day and age? Well, a lot of people are quite concerned about tracking and their online privacy, and using a VPN ensures that you are safe and secure online. Surfshark VPN provides a lot of extra added layers of security, as well as ad blocker and a kill switch if your information is ever compromised.
A great bonus feature with having Surfshark is something is not available on your streaming service in your country. You just pop on that Surfshark VPN and you can probably find so much more streaming in different countries. If you want to find something like Masters of Horror, it is available on Tubi. So just select the correct country and you'll be able to watch such a great and fantastic show.
Surfshark VPN is one of the most reliable and cheapest of the VPNs out there, with up to 81% off offer when you subscribe for 24 months. Please use the link surfshark.deals/supernetwork to take advantage of this amazing deal.
You can also find the link in the show notes.
Thank you, Surfshark. Surfy shark do 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 do. Surfy shark do 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 do.
And now back to the show.